Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Today, we're diving deep into a fascinating and incredibly complex genomic disorder called Smith-Magenis Syndrome, or SMS. We're going to unpack a groundbreaking new paper. It's titled Molecular and Developmental Deficits in Smith-Magenis Syndrome, Human Stem Cell-Derived Cortical Neural Models by Yuju Li and colleagues. It was just published actually October 2nd, 2025 in the American Journal of Human Genetics. Our mission today really is to give you a shortcut to truly understanding SMS. We'll explore how a specific, seemingly small genetic deletion in our DNA can create this ripple effect through brain development, causing everything from altered cell cycles to hyperactive neurons. It's a journey into the very architecture of the brain, and honestly, it's full of surprising facts that challenge how we think about our own genetic blueprint.
That's right. SMS, it's caused by a deletion in a specific region of chromosome 17, known as 17p11.2. It often presents alongside conditions like autism and is characterized by, well, a unique set of profound deficits in brain development. What this paper does so elegantly is use these cutting-edge human stem cell models to finally bridge that crucial gap, you know, the gap between the genetic deletion itself and the complex, often devastating symptoms we actually see in individuals with SMS.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning then. For someone who might not be familiar, what exactly is Smith-Magenis syndrome, and what are its key clinical features that make it such a significant challenge for, you know, for those affected and their families?
Right. Smith-Magenis syndrome is primarily a neurodevelopmental disorder. It's caused, as I said, by the deletion of a specific segment on chromosome 17. This means people with SMS have only one functional copy of a really key gene called RAI1. We call this condition haploinsufficiency. And this leads to a pretty broad spectrum of symptoms. Clinically, we see intellectual disability, growth challenges, metabolic issues often leading to obesity, also self-injurious behaviors, hearing loss, and sometimes epilepsy. But what's truly distinctive are the neuropsychiatric features. A remarkable 90% of individuals with SMS are also diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder.
90%, wow.
Yeah, that's very high. But with a unique twist, we see a reversed sex ratio for these autistic traits. It's about one female diagnosed for every three males, which is quite different from other forms of ASD, where males are much, much more commonly affected.
That's a real striking difference. And you mentioned a profound list of symptoms there, highlighting the widespread impact. What about specific brain differences? Did you mention those? Could you tell us a bit more?
Absolutely. When we look at the brain structure itself, you know, using imaging techniques like MRI, patients often show what we call reduced gray matter volume, specifically in an area known as the insular cortex. Think of gray matter as like the processing centers of the brain. They also frequently present with mild ventriculomegaly.
Okay, what's ventriculomegaly?
It essentially means enlarged fluid-filled spaces in the brain. Sometimes this can even progress to hydrocephalus, which is a more severe accumulation of that fluid. So these are very concrete physical manifestations of the condition you can actually see on a scan.
Got it. So it's clear SMS has this profound and widespread impact. But historically, why has it been so challenging to understand how, you know, how that specific genetic deletion on chromosome 17 actually leads to all these complex brain issues? What research tools have been sort of missing until recently?
That's a really key question. While we've learned a lot from traditional research, previous studies using mouse models, for instance, only partially captured the human condition, especially when it came to the intricate structures of the brain's outer layer, the neocortex. Our human neocortical development is, well, it's pretty unique.
How so?
For example, the cell cycles of our neural progenitor cells, these are the stem cells that give rise to all the neurons and glial cells in the brain. They're about three times longer than those in mice. This extended cycle allows for a much greater expansion of our neural progenitor cell population, which contributes to our uniquely complex brain architectures. Plus, we also have distinct cell types, like specific kinds of radial glial cells that you just don't find in mice, and different ways our DNA is organized inside cells, unique patterns of gene expression, even the electrical activity in our neurons is different. All these human-specific features make directly translating findings from mice to human SMS really, really difficult.
So it seems our brains are just, well, too complex and unique for mouse models to fully mimic. No offense to mice, of course. But it really highlights just how crucial human models are for understanding these kinds of conditions.
Mm-hmm.
How did Yuju Li and their team tackle this challenge using human cells then?
Right. So to get to the bottom of this, they developed human-induced pluripotent stem cell, or HPSC-derived neuronal models.
Okay, HPSCs.
Yeah. This involved taking HPSCs from individuals with SMS, so these cells carry that specific DelP11.2 deletion, and then guiding them, differentiating them, to become brain cells. They created two main types of models. First, there were 2D cortical neurons. These are great for detailed cellular analysis, grown flat in a dish. And second, something truly remarkable, 3D pattern dorsal cortical organoids.
Mini brains, essentially.
You can think of them like that, yeah. Tiny, self-organizing mini brains grown in a dish. These organoids allowed the researchers to study much more complex developmental processes. They could look at everything from the molecular level, like how the DNA is structured, all the way up to cellular function and electrical activity. It gives us an unprecedented view into SMS development.
Now, this next part really caught my eye, because it fundamentally changes how we might think about genetic disorders. The paper talks about 3D chromatin wiring. We often think of DNA as just a linear code, right? Like a long string of letters. But from what I understand, its 3D organization in the cell's nucleus is actually crucial for gene expression. What did the researchers uncover about how this deletion affects the very architecture of the genome?
It's truly remarkable. It's almost like the deletion doesn't just remove a paragraph from a book, but it completely reshuffles the entire chapter. What's fascinating here is how fundamentally the DelP11.2 deletion disrupts the structural integrity of the genome itself. To visualize this 3D architecture, the team used a really powerful technique called HiSeq.
HiSeq, okay.
Think of it like a high-tech camera that takes pictures of how different strands of DNA, even those that are far apart linearly, actually touch and interact inside the cell's nucleus. It's how they discovered this incredible miswiring of chromatin's three-dimensional interactions. And this miswiring was clear in both the SMS HPSCs and the 3D cortical organoids. Specifically, they saw increased cis chromosomal contacts.
Meaning contacts within the same chromosome?
Exactly. Interactions within the deleted 17p11.2 region itself, and also in the regions immediately flanking the deletion on chromosome 17. To give you a mental image, think of our genome as being organized into these things called topological associated domains, or PADs.
PADs, right.
They're like self-interacting neighborhoods or communities of DNA, each with its own sort of local rules for gene expression. In healthy control cells, the SMS locus, that region on chromosome 17, was partitioned into about a dozen smaller TADs, each acting like its own little regulatory neighborhood. But in the SMS HPSCs and organoids, the entire deleted 17p11.2 region was encompassed by a newly emerged single massive TAD.
Wow, one big TAD instead of a dozen small ones.
Exactly. This fusion of TADs profoundly reshapes the local regulatory landscape. It literally changes the genomic neighborhood structure.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, one small missing piece of DNA doesn't just silence the genes right there.
Yeah.
It actually rewires how large parts of the genome operate. It's re-engineering the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean for the expression of other genes, especially those outside the deleted region? And why should we, the listeners, care so much about these trans effects?
You've absolutely hit on a critical insight there. While the deletion directly impacts genes within the 17p11.2 region, that's what we call the cis effect, The truly eye-opening finding was that the majority of gene dysregulation they observed was for genes outside the deleted region entirely.
Really? How much?
It was a striking 73% in the HPSCs and an even higher 97.1% in the neural progenitor cells derived from them. The researchers found a highly significant overlap between these newly formed differential TADs, these altered genomic neighborhoods, and the list of dysregulated genes, especially in the HPSCs. This strongly implies, it compellingly suggests that the altered 3D chromatin topology, this miswiring of the genome's architecture, is a major driving force. It's driving the widespread indirect changes in gene expression across the entire genome in SMS cells. It's a powerful explanation for how a localized deletion can have such broad and profound effects on brain development and function. It impacts symptoms far beyond just the directly deleted genes.
Okay, that makes sense. It means a seemingly small change can just cascade into system-wide disruptions.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen how the very blueprint of the genome gets distorted because of these architectural changes. Mm-hmm. But what does this miswiring actually build? If the instructions are flawed, what does the resulting brain, or mini-brain in this case, look like? Did these HPSC models actually show developmental defects that mirror what we see in patients?
Yes, absolutely. And it's a powerful validation of these models, actually. The SMS-HPSE-derived cortical organoids showed profoundly aberrant growth patterns. At both 25 and 75 days of differentiation, these SMS organoids were significantly smaller than their healthy age-matched controls. This was especially true when looking at the largest organoids. And crucially, they also faithfully recapitulated one of the key neuroanatomical hallmarks of SMS seen in patients, that mild ventriculomegaly we talked about.
The enlarged ventricles.
Exactly. The SMS organoids had enlarged PXX positive ventricles. PXX is a protein marker that helps us identify these early brain structures. Seeing an increase in PXX plus ventricles tells us about the developmental impact. They showed a 150% increase in absolute size, and get this, a 200% increase when normalized to the total organoid area.
200%, that's huge.
It is. They also had more ventricles overall and thinner walls for these PXX plus ventricular structures. It really paints a clear picture of disrupted brain development right from the start.
This is truly impressive how closely the models mirror the patient's symptoms, you know, from the miswired genome right down to these physical defects. But you mentioned the brain's architecture is fundamentally tied to cell cycles, right? To how cells divide and grow. How did these developmental issues connect back to those basic cellular processes?
This brings us to another crucial discovery in the paper. They found clear impairments in cell cycle regulation. In those 25-day-old SMS organoids, there was a significant decrease in something called the EDU labeling index.
EDU, what's that?
NEU is like a glowing tag we give to cells that are actively copying their DNA, which happens during the S phase of the cell cycle. So a lower index means fewer cells were in this crucial copying phase. And this was coupled with an accelerated cell cycle exit. This pattern suggests that cells are leaving the proliferative cycle, the phase where they actively divide and multiply, much too early.
So they stop dividing sooner than they should.
Precisely. They confirm this in the 2D neural progenitor cells, too. They observed an increased proportion of SMS NPCs sort of stuck in the G1 phase, that's a resting phase, and decreased proportions in the S and G2M phases, where cells are preparing for and undergoing division.
So fewer cells actively dividing, more just sitting there. What else did they find about these progenitor cells? Anything else wrong?
Yeah, they also observed reduced Ki67 expression. Ki67 is another protein marker that flags cells that are actively proliferating. So less Ki67 points again to this fundamental proliferation defect. And on top of that, they even found increased genomic instability in these proliferating NPCs.
Instability. Like DNA damage.
Kind of. It was marked by elevated levels of H2AX and P53 BP1 foci. You can think of these foci as molecular distress signals. They suggest that the DNA in these cells might be experiencing damage or stress during replication, which could be another consequence of that earlier genomic miswiring we discussed.
So we're looking at fewer progenitor cells. They might be stressed. They're not dividing properly, which then directly leads to smaller organoids and those enlarged ventricles. It's like the foundations of the brain are being laid incorrectly right from the start. What about the specific gene expression changes driving these cellular deficits? Did that tell them anything about maybe human-specific aspects of the disease?
Absolutely. Their single nucleus RNA sequencing, or snRNA-seq, analysis of the cortical organoids provided incredibly detailed cell-type-specific transcriptional insights. It lets you see which genes are on or off in each cell type. For instance, they observed an increased proportion of cycling radioglia in SMS organoids. These are critical cells for brain development. And they found that gene dysregulation was most pronounced in a few specific cell types, truncating radioglia, or TRG, as well as migrating neurons and glutamatergic neurons.
Let's get truncating radioglia, TRG. Why are they interesting?
Well, the TRG cells are particularly interesting because they're crucial for forming the cortical ventricles and for brain expansion. And importantly, they're found only in gyrocephalic mammals. That means mammals with folded brains, like us humans, primates, but not mice.
Ah, so that really highlights why human models are so vital here.
Exactly. They also identified the downregulation of two specific primate-specific genes, POTI and POTEF. These genes have been implicated in hearing loss, which, as we mentioned, is a very common symptom in SMS patients.
Wow, so that's a direct link from a specific gene expression change in a human model right to a known clinical symptom.
That's powerful.
Did they find any broader connections to other neurological or psychiatric conditions?
They did. The overall gene expression signatures they saw in the SMS organoids actually mirrored signatures previously found in studies of autism spectrum disorder and schizophrenia. And some cell types, like astrolia and migrating neurons, even showed gene signatures consistent with major depressive disorder. So it really shows how the single deletion disrupts core developmental processes from the very earliest stages of brain formation, and how that might connect to a wider range of neuropsychiatric conditions beyond just SMS itself.
These developmental deficits are clearly profound and widespread. Okay, let's shift gears a bit now. Let's move from how the brain builds itself to how the actual nerve cells, the neurons, function once they're formed. Do these changes in development and gene expression actually translate into functional differences in how SMS neurons behave? This sounds like where things get really interesting.
Yes, the functional data is very telling and quite complex, actually. They looked at those 2D cortical excitatory neurons. Initially, at 4 weeks post-differentiation, or WPD, the SMS neurons actually exhibited accelerated dendritic growth.
Accelerated, so they grew faster.
Yeah, dendrites are like the antenna of a neuron receiving signals. These SMS neurons showed significantly greater mean soma volume, the cell body size, and longer total dendrite length. They also had increased neurite complexity. It suggests a kind of transient early developmental acceleration. Interestingly, though, this accelerated growth largely normalized by 8 weeks post-differentiation.
Okay, so it's temporary.
Seems so. They also found increased formation of excitatory synapses, the connections between neurons, but somewhat surprisingly, the overall strength of excitatory synaptic transmission, which they measured by looking at miniature excitatory postsynaptic currents, or MEPSCs, while the amplitude of those was normal at baseline.
Huh. So more dendrites and synapses, at least early on, but normal baseline function. That's a bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
What then explains the epilepsy and other excitability issues often seen in SMS patients? Where does the electrifying truth, as you put it, come in?
This is where the really key functional finding lies. The SMS cortical neurons showed significantly increased intrinsic neuronal excitability.
Okay, what does that mean exactly?
It means the neurons themselves are easier to trigger. A higher percentage of mature SMS neurons spontaneously fired action potentials, their electrical signals, just on their own. And when the researchers deliberately stimulated them, they exhibited a higher firing frequency. They fired more often. Delving deeper into the properties of these action potentials, they found that SMS neurons had a lower firing threshold, meaning it took less input to make them fire. They also had larger overshoots, narrower action potential half-widths, and faster decays.
Okay, break that down. What does all that add up to?
To put it simply, it makes them more prone to fire, and to fire more rapidly. Imagine a neuron's ability to kind of recharge after firing is slightly impaired. It makes it much more likely to fire repeatedly or, you know, too easily in response to input. This is directly relevant to the hyperexcitability and the seizures often seen in patients.
Right, that makes sense. A clear functional deficit linked to symptoms. So what's the molecular mechanism behind this? What's going wrong inside the neuron to cause this hyperexcitability?
So zooming out for a moment to connect this to the bigger picture, the root cause appears to be a reduction in voltage-gated potassium, or K plus, say, current density.
Potassium channels, okay.
Yeah, potassium channels are absolutely crucial for repolarizing the neuron, helping it reset after firing an action potential. They observed what are called downshifted K plus fast and K plus slow IV curves in the SMS neurons.
IV curves.
It's a way to measure how much current flows through these ion channels at different voltages. Think of it like checking the water pressure in different pipes at different valve settings. These downshifted curves clearly indicated reduced potassium currents flowing out of the cell. Meanwhile, the sodium component, which helps neurons fire in the first place, seemed intact. So this reduced potassium current means the neurons can't repolarize or reset as effectively after firing.
Which makes them inherently more excitable.
Exactly. They also found dysregulation in genes encoding certain solute carrier, or SLC, ion exchangers, and an upregulation of a specific potassium channel regulatory subunit called KCNEB3, or KVI3, in SMS neurons. Both of these could contribute to those reduced K-plus currents. So this directly links the genetic deletion through the chromatin changes, through the gene expression changes, all the way down to a specific functional consequence, faulty potassium channels, which likely underlies clinical symptoms like epilepsy. It gives us a clear potential target for future interventions.
This has been an absolutely incredible deep dive. We've gone from a single deletion to rewired DNA architecture to faulty cell division in many brains and now to hyperexcitable neurons with specific channel problems. So What does this all mean for overall understanding of Smith-Magenis syndrome, maybe even for broader neurological conditions?
Well, I think the broader implications are pretty profound. This deep dive really shows us how a single genetic deletion doesn't just silence a few genes. It fundamentally reshapes the entire 3D organization of our genome. This genomic miswiring then cascades, influencing how our brain develops at basically every level, from how progenitor cells divide and differentiate, right up to the complex way our mature neurons fire electrical signals. It also highlights, again, the critical importance of using human-specific models to capture those unique aspects of our brain development. Things like those primate-specific POT genes linked to hearing loss and those specialized truncating radial glial cells. Things mouse models simply can't fully mimic are turning out to be crucial for understanding the full spectrum of the disease.
Yeah, what's truly remarkable is that these human stem cell models aren't just sort of mimicking symptoms like the ventriculomegaly or the hyperexcitability. They're actually revealing the intricate molecular dance, like that potassium channel dysfunction that underlies these clinical features that feels like it gives us a much clearer path forward, potentially. And this brings up an important question for you, our listener, to maybe ponder. Considering how broadly a single deletion can impact the genomic landscape and cellular function, as we've seen here, what other genomic disorders might be similarly driven by subtle yet profound architectural changes in our DNA, changes we might have missed by just looking linearly? Could this open up entirely new avenues for diagnosis and maybe even intervention across a range of conditions? Something to think about until next time on Base by Base.